VOA News reporting by remote, I'm Michael Brown. Relief for the victims of it. A powerful earthquake and tropical storm began flowing more quickly into Haiti on Thursday, but the Caribbean nation's lack of basic infrastructure is still presenting huge challenges to getting food and urgent medical care to all who is in need. Private relief supplies and shipments from the United States government and others were arriving in the southwestern peninsula, where the weekend quake struck, killing more than 2,100 people. Adding to the problems, a major hospital in the capital, Port-au-Prince, where many of the injured were being sent, was closed Thursday for a two-day shutdown to protest the kidnapping of two doctors, including one of the country's few orthopedic surgeons. The abductions dealt a blow to attempts to control criminal violence that has threatened disaster response efforts in the capital. The Taliban finally dispersed scattered protests for a second day on Thursday, as some people observed the country's Independence Day by carrying a large Afghan flag through the streets before being confronted by the Taliban. August 19th is the day Afghanistan gained independence from British rule in 1919. Witnesses at a protest in Assadabad said that more people were killed there, though it wasn't clear if they were killed by gunfire, a stampede, or both. The Taliban have sought to project moderation, and they say they want good, but they will face a difficult balancing act in making concessions to the West, satisfying their own hardline followers, and suppressing dissent. For more news, please join us at VOAnews.com by remote. This is VOA News. The United States struggled Thursday to pick up the pace of Americans and Afghan evacuations at Kabul Airport, constrained by obstacles ranging from armed Taliban checkpoints to paperwork problems. President Joe Biden vowed to stay in Afghanistan until all U.S. citizens who want to leave have been evacuated, as he stands firmly by his decision to leave the country, despite the chaos that has ensued. The president stressed that the U.S. military is now in control at the airport and evacuating thousands, with the goal of getting everyone who needs to be evacuated out, both American and Afghans, by August 31st, that is, or later, if needed. Pentagon officials said Thursday that to date the U.S. military had evacuated 7,000 people in recent days, for a total of 12,000 evacuated since the end of July. Up to 15,000 Americans and tens of thousands of at-risk Afghans remain in Afghanistan after the Taliban took control of the country last weekend. Burkina Faso is observing 3 days of national mourning after suspected jihadists killed 49 people in an attack that raises fresh doubts about its armed forces. It was the third major attack on Burkina Faso troops in the past 2 weeks. The country's armed forces are poorly equipped, ill-trained, and face a highly mobile foe. Since the start of August, more than 90 people have died in attacks in the northern and northeast section of the country. The landlocked country has been battered for the past 6 years by jihadi attacks from neighboring Mali. Here in the U.S., Capitol Police arrested a North Carolina man after he had claimed to have explosives in his parked truck. The 49-year-old man surrendered and was taken into custody after hours of negotiations and evacuations around the U.S. Capitol Thursday. After the driver had surrendered, police said they searched the truck, found bomb-making materials, but no functioning bomb. Police have not disclosed what the suspect's motives may have been, and no charges have been announced as of late Thursday. And a Florida judge now allowing a lawsuit to go forward that challenges an order by the state's governor that blocks school districts from mandating mask wearing in schools. Meantime, in Palm Beach County, where parents were allowed to opt out of the mask wearing, hundreds have contracted COVID infections after 1 week of classes. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Rwandan court delays Paul Rusesabagina's verdict.
Next week is the very sad one-year anniversary of the day that Paul Rusesabagina was kidnapped by Paul Kagame's Rwandan government.
Boko Haram defectors flock towns and villages in Nigeria. There is a COVID-19 vaccination fatigue in South Africa. A Kenyan charity hopes to bring justice closer to the defenseless. And today is the International Day of Remembrance and Tribute to Victims of Terrorism.
We had a blast. So the first blast, we thought that it was a drill. So we ignored and we continued with whatever we were doing. And then another blast. When we had the third blast, that was when it was serious for all of us. So we started running, I don't know to where.
And Botswana plans to introduce tougher anti-tobacco laws. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The verdict in the trial of Paul Rusesabagina was supposed to be given today, Friday. The courts indefinitely delayed the announcement. Rusesabagina is the man portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda because of his humanitarian work during the 1994 Rwanda genocide. He was arrested in August last year and charged with 13 criminal offenses for his alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. Yesterday, Rusesabagina his family, lawyers, and friends had a virtual news conference to talk about his case. Brian Endless has been a friend of Rusesabagina for nearly 15 years and working with the family and legal team since Rusesabagina's arrest.
Next week is the very sad one-year anniversary of the day that Paul Rusesabagina was kidnapped by Paul Kagame's Rwandan government. He was lured from his home in San Antonio, Texas, to Dubai, where he boarded a plane that he thought was going to Burundi. Instead, the plane took him to Kigali, Rwanda. There, he was tortured for 4 days and has been in jail and on trial since. He spent 250 days in solitary confinement in contravention of the UN's Nelson Mandela rules, and Paul has faced a sham trial with no credible evidence or credible witnesses. He has also been continually denied full access to his legal team throughout his time in jail.
Rusesabagina's personal Belgian lawyer, Vincent Larkin, speaking from Kigali through an interpreter, said he will not attend the next court proceedings because Rusesabagina has been denied his right to be represented by a lawyer.
I will refuse to attend this hearing before the Chambre d'Instruction because Paul has been deprived of his most basic right, which is to be represented and assisted by counsel. I know that I will be supported by the parquet, and I know that I will be supported by the judge in not attending the hearing before the Chambre d'Instruction because everything is blocked. Nothing is possible. I have no access to my client, despite all our efforts to allow for such an encounter to happen.
Peter Koharis, who represents Rusesabagina in the United States, says Congress has, on a bipartisan level, called for Rusesabagina's release.
The Congress in the United States, both House and Senate, has twice now have called first for Paul's release and then secondly for the State Department to take greater measures to obtain his release. These efforts join those in Europe, the European Parliament, and even most recently, the Parliament of Belgium in calling for Paul's release and expressing concern about the fundamental denial of Paul's human rights.
Rusesabagina's family appealed to President Joe Biden to pressure the Rwandan government to immediately release their 67-year-old father because he is innocent and has numerous health problems. Today is the International Day of Remembrance and Tribute to Victims of Terrorism. According to the Global Terrorism Database statistics, more than 44,000 people died in Africa of terror-related deaths between 2007 and 2019. The UN General Assembly says the International Day is dedicated to victims in order to promote and protect their rights at national and international levels. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, victims of terror attacks in Kenya Colombia live with scars as others find it difficult to overcome the grief and trauma that comes with the aftermath of terrorism.
The United Nations Secretary General says terrorism in all its forms and manifestations remains a global challenge that causes lasting damage to individuals, families, and communities. Mariam Ali lost her two colleagues in the 2019 Nairobi Dusit D2 complex attack. She lives to tell the story.
We had a blast. So the first blast, we thought that it was a drill. So we ignored and we continued with our duties, or rather with whatever we were doing. And then another blast. When we had the third blast, that was when it was serious for all of us. So we started running, I don't know to where. By the time we were almost at the ground floor, someone in front of me was shot. And at that particular time, I was 7 months pregnant, I remember. People broke legs. They were trying to jump. I also lost colleagues, friends. It was an event that no one wants for one enemy.
Mariam says she remains vigilant and even scared of visiting shopping malls.
The incident started at one sharp. So by the time it's around five, we had already lost hope. So we don't know whether we are going to survive this thing or not. We can say at around 4 a.m., that was when we were rescued. And that thing has taught me something. Whenever I go to a new place, I start looking for an exit. It's like I'm always on alert. I'm always thinking that what if these people come back? I fear taking my kids to outdoor events.
The terrorism scars run deep. And while they may fade with time, they never disappear. Douglas Sedialo is a 1998 Nairobi U.S. Embassy bomb blast survivor. He was heading to work when he lost his sight.
I saw a truck that took a turn and went towards the American Embassy gate. Then I heard some gunshots. Then I saw a man run from the scene of the shooting with a walkie-talkie on his right hand towards the heavy traffic where our car was. Then I heard a huge blast go, and that was the end. I being able to see again, I lost sight on that particular day. My employer was not able to maintain me in my blindness, so I was laid off from my job on medical ground.
George Ngige, another survivor of U.S. Embassy bomb blast, lost his business since he could not work anymore after breaking his pelvic in the attack. He has never been compensated.
The American government assisted us in medication through AMREF. They assisted us for 3 years. When it came to compensation, because they just only compensated Americans, their employees, and the contractors. So we were left like that. The Kenya government also couldn't take care of us.
As per the Global Terrorism Database, 95% of terror attacks occurred in the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. The United Nations reports that every year more than 20,000 people die globally due to terror attacks. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The death of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shakur has led to hundreds of people who have lived with Boko Haram fighters arriving in towns and villages in Nigeria, essentially defecting. Vincent Foulcher, a research fellow at the French National Center for Scientific Research at Bordeaux, spoke to Ricky Stryak about who is defecting and what kind of mechanisms are in place at the community level to reintegrate them.
About 1,100 people coming out from certain Boko Haram areas, and specifically the areas that used to be controlled by Abubakar Shekau, the leader of the JAS faction. And these people is a mix. They are some grown men, but they're also kids and women as well. And even among the men, clear that not all of them are actually fighters. And a number of them, they are civilians who are living in Boko Haram controlled areas and who were not allowed out. They were something like serfs, submitted to a level of taxation, high level of taxation, and when with very little rights, and they were forbidden to live under penalty of death. It seems that now that Shekau is dead, basically this whole system is being transformed. Those semi captives, they can get out, and also a number of fighters, they're not very happy with the new dispensation, with the fact that ISWAP, the other faction, has taken over, and so they basically want to get out.
So it would be more prudent to say, I guess, that many of the people coming to the townships and the authorities are in fact not fighters, but some of them were people who were captives to Boko Haram, but there are some former fighters in there.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very difficult to have a precise count and to have a precise distribution in the count of the various categories. There is a tendency, especially by the Nigerian media, to lump everybody under the sort of category of Boko Haram terrorists. It's a lot more complicated than that.
How important is it for authorities, and not just authorities, but community leaders and the communities themselves, in the way that these people who are coming back into the towns, how important is the way they are received in terms of justice or not, in terms of punishment or not, as far as these enabling these communities to go forward and not making the crisis, I guess, worse by further ostracizing some people who maybe weren't involved in fighting or weren't even with Boko Haram because of their own choice?
The process, as far as can be known from what has happened before, I don't know how exactly it's going, what has usually been, you know, been done over these last 2 years for people returning. It's basically that they were screened by a sort of intelligence unit that basically confirmed their level of involvement and whether they were indeed defectors who had left voluntarily. In theory, female defectors are usually basically sent back almost directly into the IDP camps nearby Duguri. But for male defectors, there's a program, there's an Operation Safe Corridor, which is a place through which they're processed, a sort of camp where they are engaged in a variety of training, sort of ideological classes, discussions about Islam, discussion about state, the constitution, psychosocial support, vocational training, literacy, a program like this over several months. And usually after that, they are brought back to Borno State and, if possible, brought back to their community. So the government has been trying to encourage defection. And so, so far, I'm not sure that defectors, you know, as long as they are real defectors, if they are not captured by the army, my impression is defectors are not likely to get tried or, you know, processed judicially. There's not much info about what's going on in Nigerian court regarding Boko Haram. So it's difficult to know exactly what happened on this camp.
That was Vincent Falcho, a research fellow at the French National Center for Scientific Research. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 20th. Interest in vaccination for COVID-19 is rapidly dwindling in South Africa, and authorities are extremely worried. Less than 10 million people have so far gotten jabs out of the population of more than 60 million people, and daily vaccination figures have dropped by about half from nearly 300,000 a few weeks ago. Government officials are out in full force and trying all sorts of strategies to encourage people to get their shots. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
It's not even a comment, it's just part of before we get
Isaac Ndegwa goes through legal briefs at the Justice Defenders offices in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The 35-year-old is researching cases to help prisoners with their appeals. Just 2 months ago, Ndegwa too was behind bars, serving a 14-year sentence for a robbery and violent crime. But during his time in prison, he joined the Justice Defenders Legal Training Program and earned a law degree that helped reduce his sentence.
We were able to challenge that law through the knowledge that we gained. And my sentence was subjected to the same, to the remission. So I didn't serve the whole 14 years. I served now 9 years and 8 months.
Ndegwa is one of 15,000 inmates who have had their sentences reduced or were released from prison through the efforts of Justice Defenders. The aid group, which also trains wardens, seeks to make justice accessible to vulnerable members of society. Miriam Washira is Justice Defenders Country Director for Kenya.
Seeing people in prison behind bars, being able to study a law degree and finishing it, that has been one of our biggest success stories.
Okay. Justice Defenders seeks to bridge a gap by empowering those who are unable to access justice through the legal process. Kenyan High Court lawyer John Lewis Nkendi says many people can't begin a legal process because of lack of money.
A lot of Kenyans have a problem in accessing justice because justice in Kenya can be expensive. By that I mean affording an advocate for an average Kenyan is not an easy task. And so sometimes you find that a lot of them do not get quality and credible legal representation.
Justice Defenders has served more than 33,000 people since its beginning in 2007. Its legal education training in practice serves prisons in Kenya, Uganda, and the Gambia. 39 inmates have graduated from the group's law program sponsored by the University of London, and 6 are practicing law. 41-year-old Brenda Ambani is accredited with the University of London to teach law for the group. She says the demand for the group's services is high.
One of our greatest impact is having people who have studied this degree and they use that knowledge to argue out their cases in court.
Justice Defenders is run solely through donations. The group seeks to have those who have gone through its programs give back, like Ndegwa, by helping those who are locked up to get access to justice. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
Botswana is planning to introduce tougher anti-tobacco laws meant to protect citizens from the effects of smoking. Among the proposed changes currently before Parliament is a ban on smoking in public places and a requirement for tobacco vendors to obtain a trading license. From Habaroni, reporter Umkundise Dube has the details.
The latest global adult tobacco survey released in December indicates that over 17.5% of Botswana's adult population smokes. The World Health Organization says it is the highest user rate in Africa. Now, Botswana is pushing for a new anti-tobacco law that will protect the population from harmful effects of smoking. Minister of Health Edin Dekolodin has brought for debate a new law before the National Assembly.
The bill seeks the protection of persons from tobacco smoke and declaring individuals' rights to a smoke-free environment. It puts emphasis on the prohibition of smoking in public places to protect non-smokers from exposure to tobacco smoke. It is also envisaged that the outcome of this bill will make the tobacco industry accountable for the health effects caused by tobacco exposure and use, as well as reduce smoking prevalence and associated ill health.
A non-profit organization, the Botswana Anti-Tobacco Network, has been pushing for tighter smoking controls. The program's manager for the group, Thabo Katholo, says the new law is long overdue, including raising the age of smoking from 18 to 21.
That is what we are hoping the legislation will pass. And then there's Tobacco 21. Tobacco 21 has been implemented across countries, across the developed world. We want that to be the norm here in Botswana. The age of anyone who can sell tobacco products or buy tobacco products is going to be raised to 21. Hopefully, that legislation will pass. And the reason is this. Research has shown that once young kids, they don't start smoking before they are 21, they will never start.
The new law seeks a complete ban on cigarette smoking in all public places and stops tobacco advertising, all in an effort to protect vulnerable members of the community. In December, the African Tobacco Control Alliance expressed concern at the rate of tobacco use in Botswana, describing the situation as frightening. Anti-smoking advocates hope the new law will mean improved health for millions of at-risk adults. For VOA, this is Nkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Too often, judicial systems can overlook convicted prisoners who cannot afford to hire lawyers, especially in developing countries like Kenya. But one aid group, Justice Defenders, has been training inmates how to write appeals, represent themselves, and gain back their legal rights. Brenda Molinya reports from Nairobi.
It's not even a comment, it's just part of before we get
Isaac Ndegwa goes through legal briefs at the Justice Defenders offices in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The 35-year-old is researching cases to help prisoners with their appeals. Just 2 months ago, Ndegwa too was behind bars, serving a 14-year sentence for a robbery and violent crime. But during his time in prison, he joined the Justice Defenders Legal Training Program and earned a law degree that helped reduce his sentence.
We were able to challenge that law through the knowledge that we gained. And my sentence was subjected to the same, to the remission. So I didn't serve the whole 14 years. I served now 9 years and 8 months.
Ndegwa is one of 15,000 inmates who have had their sentences reduced or were released from prison through the efforts of Justice Defenders. The aid group, which also trains wardens, seeks to make justice accessible to vulnerable members of society. Miriam Oshira is Justice Defenders Country Director for Kenya.
Seeing people in prison behind bars, being able to study a law degree and finishing it, that has been one of our biggest success stories.
Okay. Justice Defenders seeks to bridge a gap by empowering those who are unable to access justice through the legal process. Kenyan High Court lawyer John Lewis Onkendi says many people can't begin a legal process because of lack of money.
A lot of Kenyans have a problem in accessing justice because justice in Kenya can be expensive. By that I mean affording an advocate for an average Kenyan is not an easy task. And so sometimes you find that a lot of them do not get quality and credible legal representation.
Justice Defenders has served more than 33,000 people since its beginning in 2007. Its legal education training in practice serves prisons in Kenya, Uganda, and the Gambia. 39 inmates have graduated from the group's law program sponsored by the University of London, and 6 are practicing law. 41-year-old Brenda Ambani is accredited with the University of London to teach law for the group. She says the demand for the group's services is high.
One of our greatest impact is having people who have studied this degree and they use that knowledge to argue out their cases in court.
Justice Defenders is run solely through donations. The group seeks to have those who have gone through its programs give back, like Ndegwa, by helping those who are locked up to get access to justice. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with highlights from day 2 of the World Athletics Under 20 Championships final in Nairobi, Kenya, where Botswana's Letsile Tebogo became the men's 100 meters World Under 20 champion on Thursday. The 17-year-old from Botswana clocked 10.19 seconds to beat South Africa's Benjamin Richardson, who came in a time of 10.28 seconds, and Cuban Shayna Ringifo, who came in third in a time of 10.32 seconds. Highlight of day 3 event will see Kenya's Louise Morara go up against Tokyo Olympics 200 meters silver medalist Christine Mboma in the first round races of the women's 200 meters on Friday. While Morara, who has a personal best of 25.46 seconds, will line up in lane 8, the Namibian Christine Mboma, who is the fastest, will be in lane 4 in the first heat. Staying with athletics, New York Road Runners have announced that reigning Women's Olympic Marathon champion Perez Jepchichir of Kenya will run the TCS New York City Marathon on Sunday, November 7th, and that the 3-time Olympic gold medalist Kenenisa Bekele of Ethiopia will double back from the BMW Berlin Marathon on September the 26th and would also make his New York City Marathon debut. The race, which was founded in 1970 and cancelled in both 2012 due to Superstorm Sandy and again last year due to the pandemic, will be held for the 50th time this year. And now to football news. Gambian coach Tom Sinfield says his Scorpions will be competitive at next year's Total Energies African Cup of Nations Cameroon 2021. The Gambia, who will be making their first ever appearance at the prestigious tournament, were placed in Group F following draws for the finals held in Yaoundé. On Tuesday, the Scorpions were drawn against former champions Tunisia and CAF Zone West A rivals Mali and Mauritania. Elsewhere, Malawi coach Mek Mwese has reacted to the draws for the Total Energies African Cup of Nations finals, saying his Flames need to prepare mentally and physically if they are to excel past the group stages. Mwese spoke soon after the draws at the Yaoundé Conference Center when Malawi were drawn in Group B alongside Senegal, Guinea, and Zimbabwe. And on to the World Cup qualifiers, where Bafana coach Hugo Broos has named a 31-man squad to play Zimbabwe and Ghana in the upcoming Qatar 2022 FIFA World Cup qualifiers next month. Bafana will face Zimbabwe in the opening match on the 3rd of September at the National Sports Stadium. They then will take on Ghana at the FNB Stadium on the 6th of September. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Claudine, Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we talk about reparations and redress.
as Namibia negotiates with Germany on compensation for colonial-era genocide, we ask, how much is enough to make amends for atrocities and other sins of the past? Reparations, remorse, and redress. On the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.